Ecology is all about interactions. Interactions between species, interactions within species, and along the themes of this project, interactions between those communities and physical processes. At one point in our conversation, this week's guest said, as a food web ecologist, you're interested in everything. So while this is a physical science podcast, I hoped to include interviews with river ecologists from the beginning, particularly ecologists who make careful observations at that interface between physical and biological processes. And I always hoped I could kick that emphasis off with this episode's guest, Dr. Mary Power. Dr. Power is a food web ecologist at UC Berkeley, where she leads the Power Lab, which has compiled careful long-term data sets in the Angelo Reserve in Northern California. In addition to her early work in Panama and the Ozarks, which we touch on briefly, Dr. Power's multi-decadal datasets on the Eel River have yielded remarkable findings about how food webs function in gravel bed rivers. And spoiler alert, it sometimes involves the sorts of things we tend to talk about here, like gravel and how it transports. I teach an ecogeomorphology module in one of the classes here at HEC, and I always lead that with the Eel River story that she shares about 20 minutes into this episode, because her work on the Eel River was part of what got me interested in ecological interactions with river mechanics processes. I also asked Mary about a couple of the ecological models and categories that have corollaries in geomorphology, and we ended up talking about disturbance and alternative stable states, as well as the box model and the ideal free distribution, which are just really helpful ideas for anyone interested in rivers. Frankly, this conversation could not have been more fun or more informative. Let me just hit a couple of production notes and a couple of definitions before we jump in. First, we recorded this on Mary's balcony overlooking the East Bay, which was a perfect setting for a podcast, but we'll also include notes of the full biotic and abiotic soundscape of Berkeley, which, given our conversation, seems like exactly the right soundtrack. And second, we kind of got started while I was setting up, so the recording starts somewhat in progress, and we do reference our pre-recorded conversation a couple of times, but nothing required for context. Finally, let's hit two definitions before we jump in, a couple of ecology terms that I forgot to define in real time. First, I use the word trophic level several times without defining it. That's just where an organism is on the food chains that Mary talks about. Is it at the bottom as a primary producer that makes its own food through photosynthesis? Or is it a grazer that eats those things? Or is it a predator that eats those things? Each of those makes a trophic level. That's all. It's just a word for what you eat and what eats you. And then second, an instar is just a developmental level of an aquatic insect. Juvenile aquatic insects go through a series of molts. And after each molt, they're a little bit bigger and sometimes have different morphology and behavior. And with that, I'm Stanford Gibson, and this week on the RSM River Mechanics Podcast, we talk river food webs, ecological models, and ecogeomorphology with Dr. Mary Power. Well, Mary, thank you so much for taking the time to do this.
Yeah.
I found your work influential for years.
Thank you so much.
So I thought we'd just start off. I've never heard of the Angelo Coastal Range Reserve. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yes, I wish this were better known. Actually, all of the UC campuses except for UCSF have natural areas that they co-manage with the UC Natural Reserve System. So Angelo is one of now 41. Davis has quite a few. Angelo is a little bit over 8,000 acres of protected area. About 3,000 of those are BLM, but it's the highest level of protection.
Okay.
And they have been very generous to us and letting us do some research up there. But the UC Natural Reserve Systems has generally, not always, but generally the ethic that you can't do manipulations there that will leave a footprint on natural landscape much longer than the duration of your experiments.
Oh, wow.
So you can do big conspicuous manipulations, but the plastic has to come out of the river and the vegetation has to grow back if you manipulated things. So that's been the ethos. Also, very strict rules about introducing even native to California species that aren't genetically native to the area so that we can preserve the phylogenetic fingerprints of where these races evolved, because we may need that variation in the future and understand the history of adaptation. So the UC Natural Reserve System is one of the biggest treasures, in my opinion, maybe the most important legacy that UC can leave to the future, but we don't get the word out enough. So it's not widely enough known outside even the field scientists community. Not all of them know. When I first came as a young professor to Berkeley, I tried to get research going up in the Mendocino Forest on the Rice Fork of the Eel River. You know, I figured 3-hour drive was worth it to get away from urban influences.
That's right.
But as deep as I would go into the woods with Bill's international scout harvester, the ATVs could go deeper and they'd find my experiments within weeks and just wreck them.
Oh,
you know, really? Maybe understandably because they didn't want to see chambers in their streams.
Sure,
but
sure.
But you can't do protected research. And then especially if you collaborate with agencies, aid agencies will say, no, we're not going to burn this hill slope. And then the ninth agency burns it during your experiment. So that's happened to my students and happens to everybody. Nature Conservancy doesn't let you do conspicuous manipulations. They want to protect the values, especially for, you know, their donors that want to see a natural landscape, not a bunch of enclosures.
Yes. So the UC Reserves is kind of this middle space that will allow you to do temporary manipulations.
Yes.
But you can count on the fact that it's not going to be logged or burned.
Yes, unless that happens outside control. Angela was a little bit burned in the Lodge fire, which was named after one of the buildings on our reserve, the Wilderness Lodge. On the other hand, it's not short-term necessarily because Bill has maintained a critical zone observatory there for 10 years now.
Oh, wow.
And my program's gone on 40 years.
Oh, wow.
So these data sets are long, and that's very precious on what's the most natural of California landscapes that remain, to learn how the baseline functions before it experiences all these multiple perturbations. And the reserve system got started really in the 60s. Ken Norris was doing his dissertation down in the Coachella Valley, and he worked with fringe-toed lizards, knew multiple generations as individuals, knew who was whom's progeny, and all the territories mapped forever. And so he went back for his capstone project for his dissertation, and they'd built a motel over his study population. I like to abbreviate the story saying he didn't get mad, he got even. His family's friends then were ranchers who didn't want their ranches developed. So they gave all of this property to UC as a natural reserve system, which was Ken's vision with two other professors. But there was no budget that came with it to have even one person there shooing off vandals or now marijuana growers or whatever. Oh. So that's been the chronic problem of the UC Natural Reserve System, is to get the funding for personnel to steward all these reserves.
That makes sense.
So that's what we're struggling with at Angelo, too.
Because you have protected land, it's not protected unless it's enforced.
We've pulled a lot of marijuana plants out, and thank heavens the 70,000 or 100,000 plant grow was in the BLM property. So DEA paid for the helicopters. Oh, otherwise, we would have had to.
So what did you first notice about fish populations on the Eel River that made you think there might be an interesting story there?
I'm going to tell you a funny story that has nothing to do with fish at the start.
Okay, that's perfect.
So I had worked on the Arbor catfish in Panama have a huge effect on algae. Basically, it's two-level food chain because when they get big, nobody in the small streams can eat them. So then they graze down the algae in barren limestone, although it's very productive because this thin veneer is dividing once a day, you know, doubling its biomass every day. So it can sustain all these fish.
Did you just say that the primary producers double every day?
That's well known, but not probably well enough appreciated by people who study benthic algae. If you graze it or abrade it, usually there's about a 1 or 2 cell deep veneer that stays behind. But if conditions are good for growth, which they are now that there's a lot of light and the floods subsided, then, and nutrients are not limiting. So then a cell can double once a day. So that means that you can be an armored catfish with those comb-like teeth and scrape it down to something that doesn't even feel slippery. And yet you can maintain 6 individuals that are that big, 60 grams of catfish per square meter.
Wow.
So it's amazing. This is the miracle. The paper I'll send you is called, it's technical, but inverted pyramids of trophic level biomass.
So that
just means the biomass that are in the various feeding levels, start predators, herbivores, that they're their prey, and then the plants, the herbivores eat. And you can have a veneer of algae that supports bugs in a clear lake, for example. You'd have to turn over rocks and you'd find a couple of bugs under every rock. That's not very many. But then you get these big fish and otters and bear and eagles that are eating. So the biomass of predators can be much larger than even their prey, and then the prey is larger than the producer if you have a clear flowing river or a clean water lake.
And so as kind of an ecological layperson, I think of a trophic pyramid as an actual pyramid where you've got a couple of cougars running around. You know, the apex predators are called apex because there's few of them, and you get more biomass as you move down. You're saying that because this is so productive in these clear systems, that you actually have more biomass at the top. It scales up.
It's that way for a couple of pretty profound, basic, fundamental reasons. You're right, the terrestrial pyramids of biomass are bottom heavy, but in water, you don't need to have a great big tough cellulose trunk to grow yourself up above your competing neighbors. In fact, you're better off as a tiny little cell because you're more nutrient limited often. So if you can float, then you need to have high surface to volume to take up nutrients. And then the top of the pyramid, you're usually gape limited if you're in a viscous medium because you can't afford.
I'm sorry, what does that mean?
Gape limited says I can only eat you if I can get you into my mouth.
And so your catfish paper has pictures of their mouths, and they're adorable. These are adorable
critters. I'm glad you find them adorable. My mother thought they were ugly.
My oldest daughter has showed up as a character in this podcast. She wants to be a civil engineer, but my middle daughter, she wants to be an entomologist, and I showed her these catfish. And she's melted.
Yeah. They are adorable, and they're very smart, too. They know the river with great topographic memory, and they know each other as individuals. But basically, even otters or even fishing birds, like some of the diving grebes, they're kind of gape-limited because they can't use their wings or their claws underwater to grab prey, and fish are obviously gape-limited.
Okay.
So that means that to be at the top of the food chain, you have to be the biggest one. And then if you're big, you tend to have a long life. And if you have a long life, you store nutrients for a long time so that when you get into eutrophication problems and you no longer have your clean water and you no longer can support your fish predators, both the values we want from lakes and rivers, that means that you've dumped in more, say, nutrients or heat than the food web can absorb. And the algae outgrow the grazing consumers and they often are replaced by more toxic taxa. Our freshwater systems, in the state that we prefer to think them, deliver clean water and predator meat. And if we degrade them with too much removal of vegetation in the watershed, too much sediment eroding, bringing phosphorus, or too much wastewater, too much water extraction, then we turn them into the green system.
So you're in Panama and you notice this about clear water system.
Well, this is something I've thought through in all of my, I have a paper advising, you know, the jet lag staffers of Congress people. It was called a Presidential Western Water Advisory Commission. And I explain this biology that leads to that. They really got it, that message that you not only, you need to protect these freshwater ecosystems, but you need to keep your nutrients high in the landscape, which we can talk about, but high in the food chain too. And that does two services. It grows the nice stuff at the top of the food chain, like salmon, and it keeps the water clean. That came together after I studied four rivers. I've had four lifetime rivers, Rio Frijoles.
Okay, in Panama.
In Panama. Then Briar Creek, which was a clear-flowing stream, not over sand, but over limestone bedrock with gravel carrying over.
And that was in Oklahoma?
Yeah, that's right on the Oklahoma-Texas border, south-central Oklahoma. Then the Ozark streams, which were clear-flowing, going through deep slate and chert deposits in southwest Ozarks, northeastern Oklahoma. And then the Eel River for the longest period. But the common feature they have is they're all clear.
Oh, interesting.
Remember, I want to be underwater seeing what's going on.
Right.
So they're all rivers that are in pretty good, or were in pretty good shape. The two Oklahoma rivers have been trashed.
Oh, really? I'm sorry.
Yeah, one of them by the chicken factories that dump nutrients into these beautiful Ozark streams. It's just heartbreaking. And the other because a rancher who'd kept his cattle off the couple of kilometers that we studied let them back in, and then the limestone bedrock was so fragile that a certain geomorphology that had isolated predators from prey, and the prey could disperse through riffles, but the predators couldn't. Oh. So that's the story that's told in the movie Serengeti Rules.
Oh, really?
You could Google Serengeti Rules, and you'll see two versions, a 90-minute and a 60-minute. And the 60-minute got an Emmy for
Really? We'll put a link to that.
Good.
That sounds fantastic.
Yeah.
So you're studying these four clear water systems.
Yes.
So in the Eel, what did you notice that made you think there might be a story?
So it came to Berkeley. The protocols and bureaucracy for working on vertebrates at Berkeley is just horrendous.
Oh, okay.
It is everywhere,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah.
But Berkeley is a very difficult place to navigate. And so I avoided working on fish for my first two field seasons. I'd been here 3 years and I was trying everything else. I was interested
in bottom. It has a backbone.
I avoided it. Yeah, exactly right. I'm not going to write an inch and a half thick protocol to work on fish. And so I did that and I got weak results that changed on repetition. And I was fertilizing and looking at midge algae interactions and just looking at everything that didn't have a backbone. Also interested, I'm actually deeply interested in the, especially the algae at the base of the food web as organisms. As a food web ecologist, you're interested in everything. But then Bill, that my third field season when I wasn't getting very definitive results from my experiments and tenure was coming up, he said, Mary, you've worked in fish in those other three rivers and you always got results. Why don't you work in fish there? So I
And this is Bill Dietrich,
my husband.
Who is a famous geomorphologist and sediment transport specialist.
Husband of almost 50 years now.
Wow.
So I bit the bullet, did the protocols, and then did enclosure experiments. And the very first summer I did them, just got amazing results. So that was the papers you've read, which showed I was going to just go through the exercise of getting you to think about what a food chain is. It's an unrealistic, simple cartoon that actually is a very good starting hypothesis for understanding.
Let's do it.
Okay, so you start with plants. If they're alone in the world, they grow to a level where they become resource limited because they're competing. Then you add a grazer that's uninhibited. And if the plants are all edible, assume that, then the grazer grows, but the plants are completely suppressed in a two-level system, so the world looks barren. So the first world was green, second world's barren, third world is green if you add a predator. So that's what the bass were in the Oklahoma stream. They were eating herbivorous minnows and releasing the algae in the pools where they occurred, but it was conspicuous that where the bass had not been able to traverse a riffle and get to another pool that was physically similar, and just minnows occurred, they were barren. So that was black-white, very obvious. So then in the Ozarks, there were probably longer food chains. Certainly in the eel, what I found the first summer was a four-level food chain.
All right. So let me see if I can reproduce this. You have these layers of a food chain, which is a simplified heuristic, obviously.
Yes.
But one of the ways I think about this is that alternate levels of a food chain are unintentional allies, essentially.
That's right. You skip the level and your enemy's enemy is your friend,
right?
So, that's right.
So if the midge grazes the algae and the carnivorous insect grazes the midge, then if you have a lot of that third level, you have a lot of the first level.
That's right.
But if you had a fourth level, now the second level grows and the first and third decreases.
That's right. That is exactly the story that you have, obviously a complex web where you've got, omnivory frogs eat bugs as adults and algae as juveniles, right?
They move trophic levels.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
There's a lot of complexity, but in certain times and places, you can find the strong chains that go through the tangled web and make a prediction that if this species increases or decreases, there'll be these follow-on effects.
And these alternate effects down the food web.
Yeah, down those strong chains. And it's not always just feeding, but here's where the wheels fall off the wagon. Those rules that you learned in one context change over space and time as the environment changes. So that's the story with Scour.
The first time I encountered your work, and the reason I think of you as a little bit of a honorary ecogeomorphologist or an actual ecogeomorphologist.
That's a great honor.
Yeah, yeah. How does flow affect the food web on the Eel River?
So you remember this four-level chain.
That's right.
So I go out to repeat those experiments the year after and the year after that, and I can't repeat the effect at all.
Science has happened.
Yes. So not only that, it takes literally a ton of sediment to anchor in one big Vexar plastic mesh enclosure because you have to put a ton of sediment around each one to keep the otters from burrowing under. And then we had to put bird netting to keep the otters from going in. Otherwise, they terminate your experiments. And so all this work, first we're 12 enclosures, then times 24, with chains of students with buckets carrying the gravel from the remote source to where the enclosure was being built, passing it, everybody with a backache at the end of the day. So
this
it was a lot of work. Within 3 weeks, these next two summers, the algae degraded, whether or not the fish were present. So absolutely no difference. It just fell apart and was detritus. I had a postdoc at the time, and he and I both noticed that California's gone into a drought. We didn't have the scouring winter floods. There was no bed mobilization in the previous winter. And what changed was there's a very large caddisfly, Dicosmicus, that became one or two orders of magnitude denser when they had a flood-free winter. So Dicosmicus get through the spring as small instars that by May, June are mostly stone-cased and large enough that most of the predators in our system can't eat them.
So let's draw a picture for the geomorphologists that are listening to this. Again, my daughter wants to be an entomologist.
And great.
So we just once spent 45 minutes on the banks of the Yellowstone River watching a stonefly go to its final molt.
Wow, that's very cool.
The rest of the family is incredibly bored, but we're in trance. But one of our favorite things, and the whole family likes this, is when we're backpacking, is the caddis flies, the Trichoptera.
Yes, they're amazing.
And they're like tanks. They literally build themselves little enclosures out of rock that makes them resistant to predation and competitively dominant with other species.
Yeah, most are cased. Some are free living.
Okay.
And some of the cases are built of litter. But in the case of Dicosmicus,
yeah,
it's stones. And in, say, January, February, the eggs have hatched. And the little first instars look like little fighter jets.
Okay.
With just a few Doug fir needles going. But what they'll maintain until the fifth instar is like the tail feathers on an arrow, V-shaped needles coming out. So those little guys float. If the bed's going to move, they can float, they can be dispersed, not die. Then second instar, there's a little bit of fine gravel coming around the head part of the opening.
Like, just like a little necklace.
A little collar. But it's still mostly these Doug fir needles that are now looking like an arrow.
Okay.
Feathers. And third instar, more so, about half and half, with the stones going from the head to the middle. Fourth instar, there are just a few tail feathers left. Fifth instar, it's all stones. The stones are coarser. The caddis larvae is bigger. It's about the size of a cigarette butt, maybe even a little bit bigger.
Wow.
You know, it's one of the world's largest caddis flies, actually. And there's a huge, lovely, plump peanut of meat in there, but fish... Only dippers can get it. They can go down to a certain depth, about 30 centimeters effectively, get them and shell them and eat them.
What's a dipper?
Oh, it's an aquatic bird that can forage underwater.
I see. Yeah. There's no fish that can break through.
Not in the upper eel. Big fish would have no trouble. I mean, really big fish, like 40 centimeter. They'd have no problems. But it's not only that they're big, but they have very coarse gravel. So getting through that's a little tough.
So after a low flow year, the Eel River is a gravel cobble river, a kind of classic Northern California.
Gravel cobble is some bedrock.
It's
steep enough in the upper South Fork that we have big bedrock formations, sandstone, where the sandstone hasn't moved. The rest of it's mostly mudstone going through. But big boulders in parts of the Eel, they're kind of like Volkswagen-sized boulders.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And so if you have a year where you don't get bed mobilization, essentially a bank full flow, you have more of these creatures, of these competitively dominant Trichoptera.
Yes.
Why?
Well, remember that life history. If you're litter cased, you may have a better chance of surviving. You might not survive, though, but you'll be exported. And if you're stone cased, you have more ballast, so you're going to get ground up.
You're essentially bedload.
Yeah, your bedload and your silk case isn't strong enough to withstand what's going on in mobilized sediments. So there's a lot of mortality in bed scour. I like to sometimes make students think of these grazing food chains, algal-based food chains in rivers as being like you look over Sonoma where all the Holsteins are grazing and suddenly the whole earth churns up and rocks and boulders are grinding up the cattle and there's blood everywhere, you know? So
I love that image.
Well,
that's
life underwater in a river.
That's life on the riverbed.
Yep.
So two phrases that I've pulled out of your papers to describe that image that you've drawn much more vividly, but flood-induced mortality of predation-resistant grazers and compensatory mortality of competitive dominance. Essentially, you have an abiotic disturbance that is a threshold effect on what the food web does in the following year.
Yeah, predator-resistant grazers and vulnerable grazers, the fish food, are competing for a common resource, in many cases, the algae. So who gets it? So the picture to draw for our listeners is you have a four-level food chain, and then you have a two-level food chain, and the decision point is whether you had winter scour or not.
Okay.
So if you don't allow enough flow through at least once during the winter, then the tablecloth doesn't get shaken out, and you don't reset the food web in a reset stage that can then better support predators, because the fast-growing grazers that come in first are fish food, but they're replaced by slow-growing grazers. The Dicosmicus is an annual. Some of these others are midges are like matters of weeks. So those naked, vulnerable, fast-growing, undefended grazers are what ecologists call early succession species. Yes. They come quickly after disturbance. And then they're both eaten, but they're also maybe outcompeted as the resistant grazers catch up. Because some of those resistant grazers aren't armored, but they put silk tents over the gravel. So you and your daughter have probably seen these. Yeah. It's Petrophila, which we call them river scabs, but they're entirely aquatic moth, and they're not very vulnerable to predators either because they spend their life as larvae under a transparent silk tent. And then when they pupate, they gather the silk together so it becomes white, and then they fly out as an ordinary looking little black and white moth.
So building a sand and gravel tank around your delicious body is a good strategy if you're not going to get crushed in the gravel.
Exactly right.
For the very reason that you're resistant to predation. But on years that you have bankful flow and bed load, those little river tanks get crushed up, and now you've kind of released the fish food. Mm-hmm. And so you can go up to the fourth trophic level, and the fish population does have some connection to bed load.
Yes, that is the story, that disturbance doesn't care whether you're vulnerable to predators or not. you're going to get crunched. But then life histories of bugs are adapted, especially in Western rivers, but in all rivers, there are a number of ways that they recover after they've been obliterated. You know, Air Force Reserve of ovipositing adults, aegli and adults, and then hiding under banks as young larvae, mm-hmm. that sort of thing. So that they've evolved with this.
That is a remarkable story. Yeah. And so this is a story you told a while ago, but you've revisited it recently. You've been at the reserve and have a long-standing field site here. Mm-hmm. But in a recent paper, you and other collaborators, you found a way to temporally upscale your observations by going to the Eel River deposits in the ocean. And so you went to the deposited sediments. What did you learn from the deposited sediments of the Eel River?
Yeah, I'd be happy to tell you that. Just preface it with these manipulative experiments, even though we have 24 6-square-meter enclosures, that's tiny.
Yes.
So community ecologists that do manipulations are always challenged to say, okay, but does your work, scale? Yeah. So I have actually two scaling stories. Maybe I'll tell you the intermediate one first and then the offshore one. The intermediate one was that, you know how our storms in California are usually bigger than our watersheds, but we got one miracle year in 2010 where Elder Creek scoured severely. And Elder Creek drains 17 square kilometers. It's one of the largest tributaries we have within the reserve of the South Fork Eel. It's usually dark. It has dicosmicas, not very many, because it's darker. And then the South Fork didn't scour. South Fork stayed under half bank full, but Elder was well above bank full and scoured completely. Well, that summer, it reversed what we normally see. Normally in the early spring, the sunlit main stem gets green, and Elder stays shaded because it's a stable substrate. The grazers are already going, and the algae don't grow that fast. But when the grazers got exported from the dark, small watershed, Elder got emerald green, algae everywhere. And yet this, with no disturbance, stayed barren. So that was a clear demonstration over sub-basin scales that this top-down trophic effect, top-down means consumer control, was operating there. But then the largest support, I wouldn't say total proof, but you never prove things in science, but more corroboration came when Jack Scully looked at sediment cores that Chuck Nitrower at University of Washington had collected with his colleagues. So he was part of the Ambari project to look at the continental shelf, and then there's a slope off of it that goes deep. He found the Eel River canyons in that mid-slope area, and he named them Curly, Larry, Moe, and Shemp.
That's great.
And a lot of the cores didn't give a clean, varve-like stratigraphy, but there were a couple that did, and one was in Shemp, where 1906 earthquake shook away the river, but by 1913 it had piled up, so it was starting to flatten out, and then pancake-like layers that could be dated with their regressions close to annual resolution formed. So I asked Chuck, the oceanographer, if they'd ever looked at diatoms, and they hadn't, and they were finished with the cores. So he generously gave us some half cores, and Jack went through them millimeter by millimeter, looking at the freshwater diatoms that grow on the green macroalgae. Rapunzel's hair turns yellow when it's a monolayer of diatoms, and then red when it deepens. And so those diatoms don't look anything like marine diatoms.
And they're going to wash out to the ocean from the whole river.
Yes.
And so this is a watershed scale signature of primary productivity.
It is a watershed level signature of whether it was a big algae or not.
Big algae year, okay.
Yeah.
So your argument is that the control is from above, that it's a predation control.
Yeah.
But it's a completely legitimate hypothesis to say, no, there's something about big flow years that cause more productivity. And so it's from below that there's more food available and more nutrients available.
Absolutely correct. Sometimes you hope that things will go in the opposite direction when you want to exclude a hypothesis. But yeah. In this case, they both go in the same direction.
Right.
Because a flood year would wash in more nutrients. And it would also maintain longer through the summer the flow conditions that delivers those nutrients and keeps the water a little cooler, favoring bigger cladophore growth. So, you know, usually top down or bottom up, it's not or.
Yeah, right, sure,
It is top down or bottom up because both apply, right?
That's right.
Both applying. But sometimes one control is stronger than the other.
I see.
So I may seem like I always get the top-down answers. I'm actually really interested in the bottom-up and really interested in the producers, too, and what they're doing. So that was extremely legitimate. It's exactly why we were interested in this question. Okay. What Jack did was he found that in the layers of the core, the density of freshwater diatom shells that are called frustals, those corresponded to my big algae years in my just throw a tape across the stream and transect it, which I'd done for almost 40 years.
Yeah,
right?
So you could temporally upscale because you could correlate it with your field work in the overlap.
Yes.
And then expand to an 80-year record.
2011 was a big algae year in terms of Mary's ski pole measuring meter, more the meter long cladophora,
yeah.
And it was a big algae year in that varve of the core. So that was the correlation. So that still doesn't exclude bottom up. And so then Jack looked at the rainfall records, how much rain fell on watersheds using all of the gauges. We just reported a few in the paper, but all of them told the same story, that there was no correlation of total rainfall with the size of the algal year. What matters is whether they had one scour. And so the algae could be actually fairly poorly developed if you had a lot of rain, but never a big enough storm to move the bed. You'd have more overcast. It showed the higher watershed yield of water and nutrients weren't as strong as the top-down forces because rain didn't predict big algae years.
So there wasn't a nice direct correlation with flow. The main issue is, was there this threshold in which you got bed movement that would exclude the competitive dominance?
There would be a relationship with peak flow.
Peak flow, okay, yeah.
And then a peak flow above, you know, say at our reach, 120 cubic meters per second.
Yes.
That's enough. And you'd only need one of those. So total annual discharge doesn't matter. In fact, the highest algae year we've ever seen was recently when we had one December peak, and then it was sunny and 70 through the spring. And then the algae got seriously about 15 meters long.
Oh,
in some cases, you can measure it that long. And then just before we were to teach our algal identification course, and my friends from the Midwest who really know the taxonomy were coming out and they really wanted to see this, we had a June spate.
Oh.
And by the time Rapunzel's hair is 10 meters long, there's a huge amount of drag. So it was just all exported. But then that export didn't have quite enough discharge, so it just went downstream and stagnated and rotted and got overgrown with cyanobacteria. So you've got these branches, you've got a longer food chain if you've disturbed the bed during winter and have reset the food web. And so that's a third reason now to give flushing flow, at least one, to the rivers if you want to grow salmon or other predators. The others are to replenish and cleanse spawning gravels, and the other is to often select against the invasive species, which are Midwestern and can't deal with fast water as well as our fauna.
Well, you've kind of anticipated one of my closing questions. So let's jump there because I work for an agency. Lots of people who are listening to this work for agencies. We manage anthropogenic works in rivers. We manage dams and reservoirs. What would you say is a takeaway from your work for people who manage rivers?
Working with the natural hydrograph of the river, at least to allow scour in winter when we can, that's important. It's important not to make inappropriate releases for other reasons. You know, the cold water messes up the insect life histories, but also it's devastating for our native California river breeding frogs. So Sarah Kupferberg's work is very important. I think in general, now that we're facing drought delusion, Tulare Lake has reformed and we're all wondering what to do about drowned grapes and that sort of thing, that we've got to think about how do we work with the natural seasonality and the changing seasonality without fighting it so much, but flex around it. That's what I would love to see. You know, outside my work, a lot of the people restoring salmon are so excited about getting access to lowland floodplains again, especially for coho in the North Coast. And if only we could switch off with growers, grape growers, or maybe it would be easier with annual crops, but compensate the farmers for use of their lands for floods when we can't fight it anyway. Let those floods replenish the water table, do all the good things they do, but then also let the coho and the other salmonids in to use that lowland spawning and rearing habit that was so crucial to them in the past and has been so developed. So if we can figure out how to do musical chairs in a way that would timeshare our habitats and let the water sink into the ground and let the aquatic life have access to it when it is a deluge year. And then we'll be better off. Everybody will be better off in the drought years. We just need to figure out the economies of, you know, which tree crops, like pecans, I understand, could have their feet wet longer than almonds. Sure. And figure out how to do the compensations for the landowners that are fair, but not fight it. The control of nature is earned, not given, was a bad motto to start with, but it's really hopeless now that nature's intensifying. So why don't we learn to work around it like so many peoples have in the past? There's a wonderful new book out called Water Always Wins by Erica Geis. And in California, there's a slow water movement, which is find the places where you can let the water sink in and raise our groundwater, but also decontaminate that water and dissipate the flood damage, and aquatic life loves it. So there's that. And then what she didn't emphasize is, and let's let the natural high flows act at least enough to do the good things they do where they're appropriate in hilly country. So I think what all of field ecologists and naturalists want to see is more tolerance and more flexibility on the parts of the humans, not this rigid, you know, concrete-based engineered control, but just appreciate and manage when it's necessary, but live with the changing template that makes the world so beautiful.
So, Mary, for the engineers and geomorphologists listening, what is the IDH?
Oh, it's a classic hypothesis developed by Joe Connell.
Okay.
And it's the intermediate disturbance hypothesis. It's a very simple idea that if I'm drawing a graph, but if the y-axis is species richness, in my case, the y-axis might be the length of the food chain.
Okay. So how many trophic levels?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. And then the x-axis is time since disturbance, like bed scour or forest fire or landslide or whatever it is, plowing. So it goes from zero to a very long time. So your species richness is very low at zero, just the survivors. And then even in the early condition, either the new colonists haven't arrived yet or the conditions are so harsh still, but it rises as the environment remains stable and peaks because it's a nice benign environment. It's been empty, the resources, but then it gets too crowded. And so that peak starts falling as competition, is the theory, starts reducing diversity. Because if there's one stable environment, somebody's going to be best at exploiting it. And the somebodies in this theory are usually the space holders. They're plants or attached algae or seaweeds or sometimes invertebrates like mussels. So it's a very general hypothesis that is actually fairly simple to understand.
So you have various frequencies or recurrence of some disturbance.
Yes.
If that's just happening all the time, you have an unlivable template and your species diversity is very low, just the really like resilient ones.
Yes.
And if you never have any disturbance, your species diversity is also really low because it's just the ones that are the specialists. But somewhere in between, where you have a moderate recurring disturbance, you have a give and take between the good competitors and kind of the resistance and resilience.
Correct, yeah.
How important is that idea or disturbance in general to your work in river ecology?
It's a very important idea. It's very general.
Okay.
In my work, there are spin-offs which were developed by other classic ecologists, Wilson and MacArthur, that early colonists tend to be good dispersers but not very good at competing and not very good at surviving predation. Maybe they have to stay ahead of their predators and their competitors, find new, recently disturbed spaces where they can live. So they're good dispersers, but they're not selected because they grow fast and often have a small egg, small larvae. You know, it's a word called propagules. There's something that disperses. And if you put a lot of those in the lottery, it's not likely you can endow each one with a huge yolk or a huge bankroll with which to compete when it lands. So there's a life history trade-off. And those features usually control things I'm interested in, like how edible are you? So say that the Dicosmicus was a species that selected to have a more stable environment, and we think of those as the species that will do well once the population recovery is asymptoted. But when populations in that just denuded and now exponential growth phase to reach the asymptote, those are the closer to the origin or the R selector, the life histories that are selected to have all the good dispersal traits and lots of tickets in the lottery.
So the Dicosmicus, if we were in a world with no disturbance, they would eventually win.
Yes.
They would take over. And it'd be very low diversity because they would be everywhere. And so in order to have a diverse world, this annual or semi-annual bankful flow, this disturbance is what keeps diversity high.
And keeps nutrients and production higher in the food chain. Yeah. That's the important part.
So nutrients at that two-level food chain, nutrients are just getting stuck.
Yeah, that's right. Like, it's a cul-de-sac.
Nutrient
it
cul-de-sac.
It is. Exactly right. Yeah, that's right.
I'm never going to look at caddisflies the same way again. You, sir, are a nutrient cul-de-sac. So we talk a lot about disturbance in geomorphology.
Yes.
Another phrase that I hear both in river ecology and in geomorphology is alternative stable state.
Yes.
Can you talk to us a little bit about what that is in ecology and if you've interacted with that in your work?
Oh, for sure. Well, you know, it's hard to talk about stability when you're in a system where the tablecloth gets shaken and all the players get exported out to the Pacific Ocean.
That's right.
But if you consider, this is very, very simple-minded, but the y-axis is now ecosystem state.
Okay.
And I'll do an example. Well, we did the example in lakes. You have Blue Lake Green Lake. And then the x-axis would be how much phosphorus were you dumping into that lake or how much nutrient. And so there's a stability which is driven by feedbacks where the Blue Lake stays blue even as phosphorus increases up to a point because the algae grow faster, but they're eaten by bugs, and the bugs are eaten by fish, and the fish are growing faster, and the lake stays blue because the nutrients are in the fish.
Okay.
However, if you put the straw in that breaks the camel's back, then you exceed what the algae that are nutritious can assimilate, and you get other cells, and some of those cells may now have a wealth of nutrients so they can make toxins. And then just the demographically, just in terms of division rates, they can outgrow the bugs because the bugs have a week or a month life history. The algae have a day life history. So they can get ahead, escape, and then they fill the lake. They take up the oxygen at night or when they rot, and then the fish can't live and the bugs can't live well, and you get a very restricted fauna of bugs that can either breathe through anal respiratory siphons at the surface or have a lot of hemoglobin. You get weird eutrophic fauna, but then the flora is often dominated by cyanos because once there's enough phosphorus, and then they can fix nitrogen, and it becomes a very difficult management mess.
And so it's not like just a disturbance that you recover from. It happens and then is self-maintaining in this new state.
This concept of hysteresis, if I were to draw the curve there, it would go Blue Lake, Blue Lake, Blue Lake, Blue Lake. Then a catastrophe occurs. The straw is put on the back, and then it crashes down through mysterious processes that are always dotted line. And then it goes flat line, flat line, flat line, flat line near the bottom, which is the Green Lake state. So hysteresis is simply if you take off the straw that broke the camel's back, it doesn't do the camel much good. So the hysteresis in Green Lake state would be that you've got these new nitrogen fixers, you've got no oxygen in the water, you've got a reducing environment where nutrients are more easily mobilized into soluble forms that the algae can take up and keep growing. All sorts of things. You've scummed over the riparian vegetation, the littoral vegetation along the lake shore, so it can't grow and it can't stabilize the banks as well. And the idea is the effort to restore it back to the Blue Lake state is you have to reduce the drivers much beyond the conditions that triggered the initial collapse because you've lost the negative feedbacks like food web assimilation and other things that stabilized it in Blue Lake state. So if you think about stability, think about the negative corrective feedbacks. And once those are overtaxed and fail, you crash, and then the degraded state has those other feedbacks that will stabilize it. That's what you want to avoid.
Anytime you cross a threshold where the feedbacks go in a different direction, just removing the stressor won't
right.
bounce back.
You can't take back the amount of phosphorus in that example that triggered the initial collapse, and it'll still stay green. You've got to really flush it out. So there are other examples in rivers. There are other examples on the slopes of our hill slopes. If you have a steep, fragile landscape like the Eel Basin, like our whole Western Belt Coast Range, and it's forested, then rain might seem good for the trees, and they'll grow better, and the roots will get deeper, and that'll stabilize the unstable sediments underneath, up to the point where the bore pressures overtax the roots, and then the trees fall off, and you get scree landslides, and then you have a degraded state that's stable because it's hard for trees to recolonize.
Oh, interesting.
So the rainfall or logging would do that.
So there was one line in one of your papers that wasn't obviously the most important line, but it's one that caught my attention the most. It's back to the cores. There was an indication in the sediment cores that there was a big event in the Eel River in the 60s.
Oh, yes.
That changed the delivery rate almost a factor of 3. And so I guess one of the things I'm wondering is, it seems like the delivery rate hasn't bounced back. Was that one of these kind of alternative stable state disturbances?
Yeah, you can call it that. The Eel was brutally logged starting in the late 19th century, and it got much worse after the GIs came back and tractors were...
Oh, really?
Yeah, they started...
post-World War II.
Yeah, post-World War II, GIs are all over the forest. There's all this good wood to build new houses with, and they got bulldozers, and bulldozers don't have to be as thoughtful as settlers with teams of oxen about where they put their roads. So they bulldozed steep, fragile slopes and unleashed huge sediment debris flows that last millennia.
Okay.
So the very damaging work. But it didn't really fall apart completely until the super floods of 55 and the Christmas flood of 64. So that was a huge event that lasted from 64 into early 65.
Oh, wow.
And with the landscape already damaged and the trees gone and the roots starting to rot and weaken, then also the settlers originally had used Humboldt bridges, big redwood logs, to bridge tributaries. So when these floods came up, they lifted those logs up, and the logs went down the main stems like battering rams.
Oh, my goodness.
Flattened all the riparian alder forests.
Yeah.
And then so all of this mayhem was unleashed by two acts of God, two big super floods, but the stage was set by the damage that had been done by the bad logging and the bad roads and the Humboldt bridges. So it turned the Eel from a major salmon-producing river, which was deep enough to have cold water bodies and copious groundwater flow into the summer. And then all these sediments came in. It got much wider and much shallower to carry the same discharge. And so you can wade across the Eel River in certain places, almost down to the mouth. In fact, we have done surveys of algal experts on foot down near the Fern Bridge.
I didn't know any of that story.
Yeah.
I just read one line and a caption of a figure in your paper. But it sounds like a classic story because the system was less resilient.
Mm-hmm.
And so a disturbance generally would rebound. It might take a little while, but rebound. But because the system was less resilient, it shifted to an alternative stable state.
Yeah, and it's very stable, but there's hope. The bad logging ended in the 70s. So in the 50 years subsequent, the alders are starting to recover. And the Eel is populated by the most fantastic community of humans that you could ask for. Everybody loves the river, wants the salmon to thrive, and is working in ways that are actually pretty congruent to improve and restore the Eel in a wild state. You know, the Potter Valley Dam diversion projects are likely to come out, as you probably know.
Yeah.
So that's really hopeful. So what's happening is the white alder that are in the south part of the Eel and then the black alder up north, I don't know as well, but these white alders always set a lot of seeds. And in those years when the seeds find the platform where the roots can track the water withdrawals, then they can establish. But after that, they need 2 no-scour years to establish. So here's a case where the no-scour is good. So you need that 3-year contingency, the right bed platform for the seeds and the water recession schedule. That has to be right so they can live through their first year.
You need a flood year where the water doesn't fall too fast so the roots can track the groundwater table.
Yeah, I'm not sure it has to be a flood year. It just has to be that the seeds have to fall at the right bed where the normal recession, the rootlets can track it. That's very well known for most river
cottonwood
trees.
Too,
cottonwoods too, yeah. Box model it's called. But then after that, an undergraduate, and this work's never been published, an undergraduate cored all the trees, and then he looked at the hydrograph, and the story is that alder seedlings are 2 week, their first 2 years of life. They have their first summer, then another summer, then another summer, and if they get two no-scour winters, they can persist, and then those saplings that are now almost 4 years old can withstand scour.
You get age cohorts that happen to be whatever the statistical chances of two no-scour
years. Of the three-year contingency, four of those have happened in the last 100 years.
Oh, wow.
So we have four even-age cohorts, and one of them we witnessed because it was in 2000. So it was all flat, wide sedge meadows. Nice habitat, but for lizards and frogs, they like that sunny, open stuff. But then alder cohorts set up, and we got even age stand now, you know, 23 years old of these alders, all the same age. And we saw huge galleries of those and have followed them. And the rivers are getting narrow and dividing. And there's more summer flow through braids. It's colder because it's shaded, but also because it's deeper. So that's a mechanism that, in, at least in some parts of the eel, the upper areas where alders can grip, that the restoration of these riparian trees will restore the narrower, colder habitat.
Again.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
So there's healing.
So one of the things I noticed as I kind of look through your CV is I recognize a lot of the names.
you might be a few geomorphologists.
Yeah, a lot of the names in your CV is kind of like my wish list for this podcast. A lot of sediment transport experts, a lot of geomorphologists. And so one of the things that I'm kind of curious about is, you know, what have you learned by collaborating closely with physical scientists in the world that I live in, this like bed mechanics world, this river mechanics world, and what have they learned?
I can certainly.
or what should they have learned?
I love the way that second question. I can answer that very precisely. When I was in Panama, I was really interested in the algae and the sediment silts in this case that would smother it, and whether the catfish were helping it out. And I was doing all this work at the scale of, you know, 10 square centimeters, 100 square centimeters, 10 by 10. Little experiments, And Bill came down and helped me map the channel, Bill Dietrich, geomorphologist in my life.
Yes.
And
in all of our lives.
Thank you. I agree.
His fall velocity method is in our software, HCRAP.
So he came down. First, he helped me map 3 kilometers. We had a plastic PVC pipe was our survey rod. It kind of bent a little, but we were very careful about that. And it sounded like a lightsaber when you pulled it out of the water. And I think that's how they made the effect exactly. And then a hand level. So we mapped 3 kilometers in enough detail that I could use the map in the rainy season, 40 centimeters above the dry season water level. And then it really turned out to be important because my fish got sparse and then dense and sparse and dense, and I thought cormorants were eating them or some fish collector had kidnapped them all or something. When I came and was camp cook for Bill and came back, they were a third as dense. Well, it turned out the safe habitat had expanded threefold, and my bathymetric map showed me that because herons can nail the fish if they're less than 20 centimeters below the surface, but more. So that's their threshold for safety, and that's what expanded even though the total river area didn't.
The subsurface depth profile changed, and that affected the predation success because birds have a depth. And you have another paper, I think, with Bill and Gary Parker where you actually have an ecological model that looks at that depth.
That's based on experimental data too. Yeah. There's too much warning between the splash and the strike if it's deeper than 20 centimeters so the fish can get away. So there's a bathtub ring of algae that they ignore, and then they can go get that bathtub ring when the water levels rise, even if the stream doesn't look that much bigger because of vertical or trapezoidal walls. So Bill got me to do that, but then he got me to think at larger scales. Remember, I was kind of close focusing like many ecologists do. And so we were walking kilometers to get to these study sites. And he said, Mary, how many fish do you think are in this pool? And I said, it's half shaded and it's got this much area of grazable substrate. So I'd say 47. And then he said, snorkel. And I snorkeled and it was like 45.
Okay.
And then again and again, 23. It was like 21 or, amazing. You know, 25.
Yeah.
So I was always within a couple of fish of being able to guess. And that led to the work that was, I think, the first demonstration at a large field scale of an ideal free distribution.
I don't know what that is.
So that's another thing we should talk about. You know, the world is a gradient of places where your food grows fast or not so fast.
Okay.
So it's easy to look at this with pool riffle, meandering
okay.
rivers, because
yeah.
the pools are grazing habitats if you're big enough to have to worry about getting eaten in a riffle by birds. So pools, there are dark, half-shaded, and sunny pools, and the algae grew about 16 times faster in the sunny ones than in the very dark ones, and the fish were about 16 times denser. If a tree fell and changed the canopy or sediments came and covered up the grazing substrates, the fish would equilibrate in weeks or months to reassume these gradients in which the ideal free says the consumer, in this case the grazer, is ideal. It has perfect knowledge in its environment of what are the good habitats and what are the not so good, and it's free to choose the best for itself at any time. So in an empty environment, they'd all go to the best habitat until competition
I see.
Made the next best habitat more favorable for one individual, so that it would go there, and then the third best, etc. So what you end up with is the productivity renewal rate of the food, not the biomass, the renewal rate completely predicts the density of the consumer, in this case the armored catfish. But then the next prediction is that the biomass will be evened out, so it'll be identical, because if algae are growing fast, they're eaten fast. If algae are growing slowly, they're eaten slowly, because the grazers are getting the same per capita return rate on food. So you have to think of rates. And then the other prediction is their fitness will be the same. And so they were growing just as fast in sunny, crowded pools as in sparsely populated dark pools, and intermediates were where they should be. So that's a paper that was the first demonstration of Fretwell's ideal free hypothesis.
That's amazing. Okay, first time I encountered your work was a river restoration class up in another one of these.
Oh, was it Matt?
Yeah, with Matt Condolf
yeah,
and Peter Wilcock.
Yeah.
That's the first place I encountered your work. It's a restoration class, and you've kind of been involved in river restoration, and I think a lot of the folks that have started following this podcast have a lot of interest in river restoration. Obviously, it's a long history. We've come a long way, but I guess in the context of this work you've done, looking at how the abiotic processes interact with the biotic process and vice versa, this story about the eel with the alders actually changing the morphology of the river, are there any takeaway lessons that you think would be really helpful to people who are in that industry or in that thought space about how do we restore our rivers?
Yeah, I guess I have two comments. The first is, I think the field is doing much better now than it used to, but there were a lot of restoration projects in Australia and the U.S. where the big wood was put in the wrong part of the watershed, so low gradients, and then it just gets covered with sand.
Yeah, right.
So there's no where you are in the drainage network, gradient and drainage area. So that Montgomery Buffington, actually Dietrich graph, he was his idea.
Yeah,
it was. Of where are you, what should you do?
Yeah.
But I think the field's really paying attention to that now. I guess my other view is that whenever possible, make it passive.
Okay.
Give enough sediment supply and enough water supply for the river to do what it was meant to do in that area. So that's kind of the let water always wins.
Yeah.
And just whatever the time scale is, maybe you're going to hold it at bay and
yeah,
then the dike
sure.
will burst. Let water win and then live with it and work with it. Maybe just nudge it, but don't try to really change it. That would be my advice.
Well, Mary Power, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for your interest and great questions.
I'd be hard pressed to choose a favorite line from that conversation or even a top five. But the phrase "an Air Force reserve of ovipositing adults," well, that one stuck with me. Almost as much as the image of the coastal range grinding up California's famous happy cows. But this big idea that in Clearwater ecosystems, it's critical to invert the pyramid and keep as much of the biomass as high on the food web as possible, that does clarify the underlying, if somewhat unarticulated, goals of a lot of restoration projects. Now, I only got through about half of my questions for Mary because it turns out that at least two more of those life rivers she mentions have ecogeomorph stories that we didn't get to that also span the sediment taxonomy. In a counterintuitive turn of events, those adorable catfish we talked about in Panama, turns out the fine sediment clearing services that they provide the algae actually outweigh their grazing impacts. And the sand transport during flood disturbance events on those Oklahoma streams impacted the relative distribution of edible algae. So I'll link to those papers on the podcast website. I also do want to say that my line of questions for Mary was a little idiosyncratic. It did focus on the themes of this podcast. But my whole family enjoyed the film she mentioned, Serengeti Rules. And I'd really recommend it to give you a framework of how Mary's river ecology is part of a broader scientific paradigm shift in the bigger world of food web ecology. Next week, we wrap up our three-part mini-series on gravel-bed rivers and this season of the podcast, talking to Peter Wilcock, most recently from Utah State. Peter is the Wilcock and the Wilcock and Crow sediment transport function and responsible for a wide range of fundamental gravel findings over the last few decades. We talked about Wilcock and Crow, partial transport, armor layer persistence, restoration channel design, and some of his newer ideas like overcapacity transport. It is not an exaggeration to say that a lot of his work that we discuss are just part of the gravel transport vocabulary that we all use these days. These are informal conversations, and the views expressed do not necessarily reflect the official position of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers or the center or institution of the guest or host. Mike Loretto mixed this episode and wrote the music for this season. I'm Stanford Gibson, sediment specialist at the Corps' Hydrologic Engineering Center, and this is the RSM River Mechanics Podcast, funded by the Corps' Regional Sediment Management Program. Thanks for listening.